So conversely, a better environment may not make better people.
A better environment, will it make better people? I'm not even thinking about making better people, really.
Well, I mean, it's like,
or making better is
it?
Yeah. No, it has more to do with my emotion than it does with my utopic feelings. I'm thinking much more about my outrage and my sadness, tremendous sadness about dead trees and apples that aren't real, that they're all shiny, Washington State apples. And so many things that all seem that make me sad. There's a lot of grief about things. It's not that it should be better or man should be happy. I don't have any kind of utopic thing. It's much more emotional reactions to what is. Fear, anger, grief, shame. And yes?
One
second. Remind me again of why that heals?
Why that heals?
Remind me again of why that heals.
Why what heals? I'm sorry.
To be in touch with our grief about something. Why is that in and of itself healing? Or does it imply some kind of, well, if we're in touch with those feelings, then somehow a principle of action will reveal itself.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have a way of explaining that. I just need to hear it.
Well, no, it's a hard one. I mean, it doesn't just come out. I mean, I have to dredge it up. The answer's there. It has to do with being anesthetized. And that by being anesthetized, we have, instead of grief which connects us to something, a community of grievers or grievances, we're left with depression. We're isolated. See, the emotions don't really isolate us. It's when they're cut off from the world that we get isolated by the emotion. Anxiety and depression and guilt instead of shame.
So this is this plan, and we're really sensitized now. Am I then healed? Or is there another step?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, that's a big one, too. Am I then healed? If I am sensitized, am I then healed? What happens if you don't think about healing? If you don't let healing get into your language? Then you're a living being who's sensitized. Wouldn't you walk the earth in certain ways that would keep you from adding to your pain, and you would be moving in ways that would be full of respect and care and all kinds of things like that? You wouldn't be trying to get healed. You would just be trying to walk your life without adding to the pain. That's a lot. You would be engaging in all sorts of actions that would have more sensitivity in them. I want to keep healing out of it because it tends to be self-centered.
Okay, how about being whole?
I don't know what that is. That's an idealism for me, being whole. I use Yeats's phrase: "Nothing can be whole that has not first that has not been bent or rent." Is it bent and rent? Bent or rent? So I have to tell you, I have certain words that I usually shoot down real fast when they appear. One of them is wholeness, and another one is healing. So I have tremendous prejudices about certain words, and I beg your pardon for that, but I don't know what we're talking about when we talk about whole. And I think that healing tends to mean, you see, I was listening to James Lovelock, the man who invented the Gaia hypothesis and found this little way of measuring that measuring instrument so that he could detect a gas drop when it was released in Japan. He could detect it in England a day later. And incredible little scientific, the old-fashioned sort of inventor scientist. And he's the one who did the first measurements on the ozone layer by himself going on a boat all the way down to the South Atlantic and then coming back up and doing measurements every day without any grant from the NSF or the British so-and-so. Just what he talks about is small science. So, now why did I say about him? Gaia, but before that, healing. Oh, yes, he said, you see, the ozone problem is not the biggest problem today. The methane gas in the forests of Brazil is really the big problem in the climate changes. But all the money is going into ozone business research because human beings are afraid of getting skin cancer. So you see, our constant anthropocentric fantasies about ourselves, one of them is healing, being healed. That's not the issue. Being sensitive is the issue, it seems to me. Well, you could discuss it, but
we're the only things that are alive.
And that, because we're the only things that are alive, we're the only things with soul, we're the only things whom God really cares about, and so on. It's vicious. It's vicious. And it distorts what goes on the planet. So his concern is keeping the planet alive, not necessarily focusing on the human being as the main focus.
Walking around feeling gut level sorrow and grief and anguish, mm-hmm. because the vast majority of the population ain't interested. They're not interested in doing the political action that's going to save the planet and all that. So I need those words in my head.
Okay, and I think we all need a philosophy or a religion or a cosmology or something. I'm sure we all do, but I think. What I want to do is not talk about that particularly, the larger spirit questions of what your philosophy is, or what your religion is, or what the theology is, the belief system that you may feel you need. I would ask you though to examine the belief system to see what effect it has on what you do, and not just to have it. So that's what I tried to do about healing. I tried to suggest that the belief system in healing does tend to make us anthropocentric. Do you see what I mean? It isn't just that I'm discarding that word. I see the negative effects of the way that word, what happens to us because of that word.
Well, I think that's personally, a very narrow way to look at it.
Okay.
And I believe that healing is a word that we definitely need to keep in our vocabulary, especially now, and that healing is a part of a cycle. When you describe what you're talking about, I see this kind of narrow, straight line. And I don't experience the world that way. I experience the rawness and the need for some form of understanding, which to me would be healing, or some other word. And then strength that comes from that for more action or life in a sensitive way until there is again this kind of injury that happens. This happens to the planet and then that whole process again.
It
angers me to hear you talk that way. Coming from my belief system, which is a part of I couldn't have meaning in my life without my belief system. Tell me again why you separate out.
I try to live much closer to the animals. I don't think they have a big belief system.
Why?
Because they're immediately engaged in the world, and most of our belief systems, such as we see every day in the religious cultures, are causing the most incredible devastation.
Yeah. Well, that's assuming that my belief system is of that view.
No, of course, but belief systems as articulated, particularly in religious systems, and that's where we see belief systems most active.
Then we need to expand our perception of the belief system.
That would be healing. That would be being sensitive. As you're saying, is that healing is like healing your wound, your specific wound. There's so many wounds to heal. But if we're sensitive to all the wounds. It's an opening to me. The healing is a focus.
The animal's an image of a sensitive being operative in the world. They aren't prevented from acting out in relation to things, and they don't only experience as a raw experience. They experience the world, I'm fantasizing, in many different ways, not just raw, not just narrow. And they're very much engaged in life at the same time. All the dimensions that you're
talking about animals.
Oh, I use animals as... See, I'm a very primitive person in the sense that I go with the old... all those tribal people for whom animals are gods.
That, you didn't sound to me that way. I was talking about that. So, I'm confused about that.
Well...
I feel a great relationship to early... I think that I'm probably a pantheist. That's how far I've gone in terms of relationship to nature or but that to me is a belief system. How would you define that?
I don't know. I have just so much trouble with belief. I just have so much trouble with it. See, the Greeks didn't believe in their gods. I didn't really use the word that much, pistis, or faith. Faith became a very important Christian idea, credo, I believe. And the God of Christianity needed belief. That was how you related to the God, through belief. That's what the God asked for. I believe in, so on and so forth, the credo.
So it's the word belief that, what belief means to you that is the negative for you personally.
I think of that sentence of that where Jung's, you remember the film, Jung's film? He says, I don't believe, I know, or something like that. And he didn't mean in an arrogant way, I know the answers. He meant belief just gets in the way of immediacy. Because then you're dealing with what you believe in the belief system and the theoretical structures or whatever. I guess that's really what I mean when I go back to the animal.
And we need to each define what belief means to us.
Yeah.
Because belief means no to me.
Means no.
No.
To know.
I see. Experience through a long period of experience. And not have to question or analyze.
But belief doesn't require knowing. And that sounds like a fairly accurate description of animal way of belief.
Yeah.
A lot of experience, and then they act out of that experience.
Yeah. Santayana calls it animal faith. It's that sense that the next step I take, the ground's not going to give way. I couldn't make any moves whatsoever without that animal faith in that when I inhale, there's air there to inhale.
And
so it's something immediate and just given.
That was the problem over here, was it not? That you couldn't believe that the rock was animated. If there was something you can tell me, that would allow me to believe rock is animated. Since I can't do that act, I can't believe the rock. See, the problem may be with the belief and some failure or some there at that level, but not necessarily that there isn't a soul in the rock. That's the jump, that's the assumption it sounded like to me that you're making.
Yeah, not necessarily.
But given that you
have a thought or an inference that it's yours. Now, if we lived in another kind of culture, if you have a thought, the thought might come to you. We think we generated our own thoughts, that they're in some way mine. And remember we quoted Blake the other day, who said emotions are divine influxes. Now we think if I have an emotion, that's my emotion. But in another culture, if I have an emotion, that's terror walked in the room, or horror came in, and now I've got it, like those little Japanese demons or Tibetan figures that are outside the temples. And so those are objective emotions that assail you in the middle of the night at 4 o'clock in the morning. You wake up and a whole lot of worry goes, walks right through your mind. It spends about half an hour with you, and then he goes and worry walks away again. So these are objective divine influxes that come at you. And so thoughts can be that way too. Inferences might be that way too. If we let go of the notions that we are fond of, that we own our thoughts, we own our emotions, we own our feelings, they're all ours, then maybe the thoughts that come to you aren't yours.
Just like the rock's not yours.
Oh, I know that. Oh,
and that's necessary up to a certain point, but but then you have to disown the whole thing and let go of it. Of course, you have to own it, and then you have to disown it. I think that's not mine. These things are. But you started, please.
This past weekend I took my niece to a play, and it was called A Coyote, and it was a Nez Perce Indian Tales, and it's all acted by a single individual, and very well done. And the prologue, he says, these tales are of a time long, long ago when everything had the use of language.
And when everything
had the
clouds
language.
Talked,
everything.
Fir trees talked, the waves talked.
And I thought, well, that must have been, the fall of man. We just fell out,
Or we usurped.
We usurped or whatever.
Stopped listening.
We stopped listening. We stopped being able to hear.
Well, the Irish saints could hear.
They haven't lost the sense of language, but we cannot hear it.
The saints could talk to the animals, at least. Irish saints especially knew the language of birds. Then there's a Mohammedan thing that says, in the beginning, animals had fire and animals had speech. But the rich always give to the poor. So the animals gave us fire and the animals gave us speech. That's why they don't have it anymore. They gave it to us.
Actually, your question is a hard one. I want
to... His question.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, he's crucial. It's crucial. Don't go home yet.
The history of these things being alive is far longer than the history of them not.
That's a good point.
And that's fact.
The fact is that the history of man believing they're alive is longer.
Well, we don't know whether they are or
right.
not.
Okay. That's still unsettled.
We'll stay there. To me, they are alive. Mm-hmm. To you, they're not right now. But it's an unsettled issue at this point. But there is a long history of men believing they are alive and a very short history of men believing they're not. I think that's true.
There are two things, too, alive and conscious.
And
I want to even go further and say they're conscious.
For primitive man, they were alive, and I would add also for the alchemists, matter is alive.
I was in a Hopi village not that many years ago in April, and I was there for a dance. I mean, these people talk with nature. Nature talks with them. They did this dance, and I heard that they were asking for snow.
I'd like to take just a pause. Let's take a pause for a few minutes. What's your way of doing it?
Actually, I think we'll probably have to stop at 10.
Oh,
so
really? Is it
9:30?
It's 9:30 already.
What?
Oh, it's 9. Being conscious, because consciousness has meant interior subjectivity, memory, intention, memory, intention, subjectivity, continuity of reflection. Well, there are a lot of words that are very active, like alert, awake. Most of the words are rather aggressive, too. They have to do with firing,
stimuli, so on. Now, I want to talk about animal forms, and I'm based now on a Swiss biologist called Adolf Portmann. Some of you may know him. And his theory, he died just about 10 years ago, and his concern was with the presentation of the way animals present themselves, not the way animals, zoology studies animals in terms of their hormonal systems or their nerve systems or their internal environment, but in terms of the macro animal, how the animal, what it does, how it looks, and so on. Now, he says that all living things are urged to present themselves or display themselves, that's a basic sign of life, that appearance, I'm translating from the German, appearance, like experience, meaning internal experiencing, a very simple cellular thing, retracts when it's touched, pulls inward. The irritability of protoplasm, as it was once called, the thing goes like that. Well, not only is experience a basic sign of life, of living organisms, but display is a basic sign of living organisms. Appearance. All living things are urged to present themselves, display themselves, or show. Another word for showing is ostentation, the Latin word ostentatio, which was the Latin translation of the Greek word. Whenever the Latins translated a Greek word, fantasia, they translated it as ostentation, ostentatio. So follow that thought for a moment. That is, each animal's ostentation or presentation of itself is its fantasy of itself. All animals are presenting their fantasy in their display. And that these images or self-starsha, these self-displays of the animal, is its interiority made visible. That the interiority of the animal, interiority is completely visible in the coat of the animal. What it is, its internal fantasy image, or what the artists like Michelangelo called the immagine del cuore, that is, the image inside of a person in the heart, is displayed in the visible form of the animal. And he says that the display of the animal is an aesthetic event without ulterior function. Without ulterior function. And he brings evidence of what he called unaddressed appearances. That is, the appearance is not addressed to another animal. And then he spoke of small, transparent, oceanic creatures that live in the interiors of other larger creatures. So you've got little tiny jellyfish, medusas, little tiny things that are inside much larger oceanic creatures that never come out into light. And yet they have a coat, they have color, they have symmetrical patterns. He spoke of certain creatures that live below the depths where light can reach and have no visual organs themselves, so that their brilliantly vivid and symmetrically patterned forms serve no functions. They can't be seen, neither as messages to their own species, or as attractions, or as warnings, or as disguises. Sheer appearance for its own sake, which, if those of you know aesthetics, that was Kant's idea of purposeless presentation. Aesthetics had to do with purposelessness. It wasn't for something else. Now imagine this. This means, as he says, here is self-display in the purest form realized. The appearance is the work of specific innate structures, and it is its own purpose. Now that means that the color of the rockfish, the coat of the tiger, so on and so, the plumage of the bird, are all there not only to camouflage them or attract the same kind of species or as signals or as warnings or as protecting territory, all these useful reasons, but it's there because it is the ostentation of the species' own fantasy of itself. In other words, the bird wears all that because he likes to look like that. That's his fantasy of himself. Now that makes it sound very jokey, but the point would be that fundamental to human to biological life, not human, but biological life, is display, and that that's just as fundamental as experience. Now we have defined consciousness with experience, with an interior life of some kind of interior life. Suppose that were to shift and we were to add to that consciousness is defined not just by experience, because that's the thing we say the rock doesn't do, is experience. It has no interior life, it has no memory, it has no nervous system, it has no sensitivity, it can't experience. Therefore, it's not conscious. But we're conscious because we have all that. Now, if we go from Portman, then the display of a thing is also where is also its consciousness. That's a sign of living, of life, how a thing presents itself. He also talks about, phylogenetically, that he's also saying, you see, that beauty is given with existence, that it's absolutely basic. He's saying that the aesthetic is biological, and that the aesthetic is not just some little additional thing that you decorate yourself with or decorate the house with, or that it's ornamental, but that aesthetics is biologically based, and that the organisms, that living things, are fundamentally aesthetic. And he says, for example, that the eyes... Well, that the structures of patterning, coloring, and symmetry are as genetic as the ocular organs that allow seeing these things. In fact, he says, the coat, the skin of any living form, is genetically prior to the eye that sees the coat. Phylogenetically, the skin occurs before the eye. And when I use the word skin, I mean the outer covering. Now that's if you think about that for a minute, it's absolutely fantastic. It means that all things are, the world is an aesthetic display. That beauty is absolutely given with the universe. That's the first thing given, is show. You know, we have that in hymns, the world declares the glory of God. The whole world is celebrating God, God is manifest in the beauty of the world, and so on. So, from a religious point of view, this isn't anything new. But it's certainly new, if we think about it, if we connect aesthetics and biology this way. It also gives an enormous importance to the way things appear. As if images, or the way you present yourself, or the image that you are, is a manifestation of your inner fantasy, let's say. I don't know what else to call it. Image. Did you want to say something there?
How can you call something aesthetic if aesthetic is prior to vision?
Go ahead.
How can you isn't aesthetic a word for what the eye does?
No, I guess I'm using it in a broader sense, in the sense that display would be the formal display, the color, the pattern, those things that we look at when we look at an image. Shape, form, color, pattern, symmetry, asymmetry, all of that would be aesthetic.
Mm-hmm. But I'm stuck where you say it's genetically prior to the eye. Isn't the eye necessary?
No, that's just the eye. That's just the extraordinary thing of this, is that genetically these creatures, that this stuff appears in life forms before the eye, the organ that can see it, appears. So he's saying these things appear even though they can't be seen. They're not addressed to anyone. They're pure revelation of life. It's a very, very interesting thing to think about.
But how does he know that those animals did not evolve the other
way? I don't know. I don't know enough marine biology to know.
Well, if that's the argument, though,
yeah,
it could be that the animal has lost its eye.
That same kind of animal has lost its eye, and it's it's degenerated,
yeah,
devolved. Mm-hmm. Well, I had, you know, when I work with other people's fields, whether it's classics or biology or whatever, I have to work with the authorities that I, and then read about them and so on and so forth, but I can't argue their argument. But I think, knowing him, and I knew him for about 20 years, I think he knew what he was talking about, because he would have met this argument, surely, himself. Entertain the idea. Ideas are to be entertained anyway. They're not to be believed. So you're back with belief again. And we're so stuck in our Christian tradition of belief, credo, do I buy that or do I not buy that? Entertain it. Entertain an idea. Entertaining means to hold between. That's all you have to do. What?
What does believe mean?
I don't know what belief means. I don't know what it means. I haven't looked it up. That's what doxa meant. Yeah, it meant to have opinion. It was a form of opinion. So I would suggest, what do you do? What's the value of that idea if you pursue it? And what does it do for you? And it doesn't mean that we should all dress better. I don't think that's the. It may mean that.
Yes,
it would. It would bring us to the point. Right, and it would also suggest that the rock's mode of displaying itself is the way you read it, the way you understand that it is conscious, that it is displaying an image. And that some things are displaying very unhappy images. Bad chairs are displaying unhappy, sick images. That they're not, they don't have, they haven't fully realized something, perhaps. That they're not full aesthetic forms.
Made a big logical jump there.
Go ahead. In what way?
Notion that living things display themselves.
What about inanimate things?
And then to jump to the chair, which is created by a human being, it probably does display somebody's fantasy perhaps of itself.
Well, now, see, is the fact that I make a chair, would that I could, but say I made a chair, is that really only me that makes the chair? Where does that chair come from? Doesn't that chair come out of the materials and out of a collective consciousness of what a chair is and a whole lot of other things as well? comes out of Naugahyde and whatever else.
Oh, that's part of your inner fantasy that you create, creating that chair.
So, here I am, a chair, and nobody wants me.
You're saying, yeah, something shared here in the creation of
Yeah, I think there's more than just me making a chair. I don't know quite what it is that goes into that chair, or how much in Plato's sense the idea of the chair begins to take shape, material shape.
Well, you didn't have injected molded plastic, did you?
No.
You could make any shape you like. The material's far removed from nature. But yeah, it's a process.
But you're making a radical distinction between living forms and inanimate forms.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes. And I'm not. Yeah. And that's the logical jump you're questioning. Mm-hmm. Yes?
If we take the display of an object that creates consciousness, what does that do with the idea of consciousness and being knowing with?
Well, knowing with each other people?
Well, who knows? But to know with, to be able to split apart and from the one many. In consciousness being created that way.
Well, I don't know. I think that's just, I agree with you. That's one of the ways we're trying to extend consciousness beyond an individual subjective knowing to a related knowing, but I want to get away from that altogether by locating consciousness in the visibility, in the beauty of something. Beauty there meaning the radiance. I mean, again, using Platonic language, that beauty has to do with this. That if there weren't beauty, we wouldn't be able to see anything. That beauty is that which makes visible. And therefore, beauty was associated with Venus and with Aphrodite in their mythological way of thinking, the Neoplatonists, because that meant the world without Venus and Venus Aphrodite, the gods wouldn't be visible. We wouldn't be able to see things. And even the Islamic philosophy, which was monotheistic and came out of Neoplatonism in a way, said the same thing, that without beauty, nobody would know God. God's visibility was through beauty. So I'm using the word aesthetics rather than beauty, but therefore, the aesthetic is so crucial because we can't really be in the world without being sensing it.
It is not, going back to what we were speaking before, is not a dilemma for most people today that if you begin to awaken to that sensitivity, as you mentioned, ugliness makes the deeper impression. And you spoke about the community of the suffering trees. Well, as people begin to awaken that, their initial experience is to be tremendously overwhelmed by both the sorrow and the ugliness of the world. And indeed, I think that's been... If we study both the condition of the saints, the people like Ramakrishna, St. Francis, they pass through a place of being able to find the beauty, but some people don't get to that place. They get to a place of being overwhelmed by the ugliness. And I think on one hand, that's why people resist that awakening, that sense.
That's a very good point. Maybe that's one of the reasons we resist, or why we cling to our theory of knowledge. It would be very painful not to have it anymore. It's the like Plato being in the cave.
Yeah.
So we cling to the theory of knowledge that the world is dead and doesn't sense and doesn't matter, is only matter, because that keeps us from feeling for it.
Because I think that in today's world, many people would feel it completely immobilized if you were to suddenly wake up the next morning and everything was alive.
Well,
I'd
be willing to take that risk.
That happened to me. I'm real glad.
No,
because that aliveness might be real ugly.
What do you
mean? Real hurting? Yes? No?
Well, you know, that has been my experience also, but I see, I have three sons, and I see as they
on one hand, are very immediately involved in the world. It is a life for them. On the other hand, especially the way that they're fed information today, if you start being sensitive as a child to the possibility of the destruction of the world, to AIDS, to the way it's fed, you begin to see the child withdraws from the world and is overwhelmed. The other thing that keeps going through me is the traditional story of the life of Buddha, which is another way of facing that. Because in the story, from childhood, Buddha is protected in the sense we could say he lives in the realm of spirit. And only when he goes outside of the wall of the castle does he meet the realm of soul,
mm-hmm.
which is the realm of death, old age, suffering.
Mm-hmm. And philosophy.
Yes. But, indeed, his struggle is
the fourth,
how it comes...
The fourth form of death, yeah.
But, I mean, I heard what you your points about Buddhism, and it's interesting to me for a number of reasons, but I think we forget that Buddha's whole spiritual path was motivated by, indeed, deeply healing suffering.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So it's another way of, when you awaken to that reality of suffering, you can be overwhelmed. You can seek an attitude, let's say, that develops out of Buddhism toward it. But I think we have to be aware in that awakening to sensitizing that it's a delicate passage. You know, you take somebody from our culture and you put them into a third world country. And there's an awakening that takes place there also, and sometimes people are move through it and become far more alive, and sometimes people are cracked in the process.
Well, are you suggesting that we not wake up?
No, I'm not suggesting that at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt also, last night I spoke to you at the end of the conference in which you spoke, which is, you said about the education in our world and about what we do to close down the soul of our children and that we should open up the soul, and I certainly agree with you. But once again, as a parent, how do we also teach our children to navigate and survive in the world? And I think those two issues are related. Yes, open up soul indeed, but at the same time, there is a survival question in that process. And I'd like to hear you say more about the survival aspect of it. Especially in my own work, I work as a spiritual guide and also as a therapist, and I'm a parent. And I want to hear how those two find some balance.
And the two being waking up and waking up of the soul and how to navigate.
Yes, and how to survive in that awakening process within the world.
Well, I think that the navigation belongs a great deal to Coyote and Hermes. And that has to do with having a certain amount of smarts, street smarts, not literalizing, not getting caught by the literal, and at the same time not losing the ideals and the romance and the beauty, but to recognize the importance of Hermes, Coyote, Trickster for living. We tend, you see, either to live Coyote, Trickster and end up like Bursky, or we become moral saints, literalized Puritans, and lose the Hermetic. You see, the Greeks had so many gods that they had ways of understanding that there are many ways of living at the same time. And what belongs to commerce and exchange and the marketplace, in other words, the city, streets, the smarts of daily life, how to buy a car, second-hand car, is a Hermetic thing. And it's also a Coyote thing, because it's got obscenities and gutters and shadows in it. And that's all part of the instruction, seems to me, of a parent, is about Hermes.
Street smarts.
Street smarts, exactly. But that is not supposed to be taken to the literal extent that becomes monotheistic God. You're one God, because then, as I say, you become Bersky. You have to still have Venus, Saturn, Jupiter's joyousness and generosity, and so on.
Who the hell is Bersky?
Nobody knows Bersky. You don't read the newspapers about the man put in jail for... Yeah, it's B-O-E, isn't it? Bersky? You call him Bosky out here. Okay. It's the West Coast. Well, then we'll talk about Milken instead.
Yeah. What do you make of...
Do you follow me there on that?
I follow you.
Yeah.
And I thank you. And that answers my question in terms of your parents. Moving through that to get to a place that also sees the beauty.
It's not a moving through. No, it isn't. That suggests that you move through the ugly to the beautiful. I don't think that's it.
I'm saying that you move through it where that is all that there is.
See, I think that the pain is what makes a person more beautiful. Mm-hmm. So that exploration of what you call being overwhelmed, and I'd want to know in precise terms with that particular person, what are you talking about by being overwhelmed? Because that word doesn't mean anything to me until I see exactly what's the image about overwhelmed. What are you feeling? What's actually happening? The moment you do that, you're not overwhelmed. You're engaged. You're not overwhelmed. And it gets precise, and there's something right there to work with and talk about. You understand what I mean? Yeah. So... And being, you know, one of the things you do is to let the river carry you for a while, or a great wave turn you upside down. That happens. But at least you've got some kind of image about it, and you can work with that. So I think that it isn't, that the pain is perennial. That's part of sensitivity, is the pain. But it also makes a person more beautiful, or more susceptible. Yes. Well, Plotinus has a great phrase for the ugly is going over to another order. So it means, as I understand that, it's like losing the track somehow, getting off track. It isn't beauty and form and ugly forms or something like that. It's being off. Forgetting, in a way, the ideal, the romantic ideal, even the longing for something more. And I think that the ugly then is that it's like loss of the wing, fallen, a lost wing. So that would be what the person who tries to pick up the bits of trash and put them into a collage or do something with them is trying to restore the wing to that fallen debris. And there may be too much debris and it may not be possible to do, but that would be the idea of, you know, restoring the wing to it. Yeah, please.
Mars was a lover of Aphrodite.
Yes, Mars was a lover of Aphrodite. That's a good thing to think about. Yeah.
It seems that there's a courage that's somehow required to engage in beauty.
I see. Yeah, that's a good point.
What does it take?
It's a courage, right? That's a good way of seeing it, right? Mm-hmm. It takes courage to do that.
Oh, that reminds me of a story. That's very good. There's a patient I worked with who was intelligent and sensitive. You know, they all are, but... Isn't that right? So, he went away, if I can remember it now, because it's a little while ago. But anyway, he went away, he was over in England, right. He was over in England, and he went down in the tube, in the subway. And there was musicians down at the end, playing. And they started to play, was a violin and a, I don't know whether it was a cello or a viola, but anyway, these two string instruments. And they began to play a piece of Bach that he knew very well. And when he heard the first notes, he thought, oh, God, listen to this, you know, these amateur crapo people playing this stuff down here. He was too sophisticated to him. He moved down the stairs, went towards the thing, and they were moving right into the first movement. And it hit him so tremendously that tears started, and he couldn't stand, he couldn't stay there, and he ran out of the tube station. Didn't get on the train, he fled. Because the beauty was so intense and so overwhelmed him and so surprising that he didn't have the courage to stay there. And I'm not blaming him that he should have stayed there, but just as a reaction, he fled the beauty. He fled what it did to him. So that's a... That's more, you see, that's more of a therapeutic moment than all the talk that we had had. And I think that is, it does take Mars to meet Venus. That's a very good point. Yes. He was married to her.
Right.
Yeah.
And perhaps he, the mechanic, being the one who caught them, stopped that liaison and some significance to this discussion.
The mechanic?
He was the engineer. The smith.
Well, he also made things. I mean, he didn't just repair them.
Well,
yeah.
In the break, I was chatting with a lot of people, and the question kept coming up, and so I kind of directed to you.
Mm-hmm.
Earlier in the evening, you were talking about. It sounded like you were encouraging us to all get involved in political action. I know you well enough to know that wasn't exactly your intent. And I wonder if you could clarify what you mean by that and what that has to do with archetypal psychology.
Okay. I suppose I have to be careful because it wouldn't be just a jump like... say, Chomsky saying, look, you guys, you ought to get out there and deal with the world. Part of me feels that way, but I have to keep that apart from what I'm trying to say, which is that, first of all, that psychotherapy, I believe, depoliticizes people. It depoliticizes the patient. And I said that in two ways. One, by introverting the emotions, which connect you to the world. And I suggested that instead of grief, we deal with depression. Instead of shame, we deal with guilt. Instead of fear, we deal with anxiety. Instead of desire, we deal with need. And we convert emotion into subjective states and then work with that. So that's the first way I believe we depoliticize. And the second way I believe we depoliticize is by concentrating on childhood. on the past, but particularly the child, so that the archetype of the child is the dominant archetype in psychotherapy, it seems to me, today in general, in different schools, whether it's Kohut or Lacan or Jungianism, which has become very developmental in its concerns, some Jungianism, or whatever, that the child, or what's her name, Alice Miller, that the child is the dominant sort of figure. And the child doesn't vote. Yeah, I mean, the child
is... Nobody here in this room was guilty of any of those.
Of course. So,
but tell us about us.
You don't think that that's... You don't think that's the case, either of those moves?
I think that's the theoretical case. I think that's the case in the literature. It certainly isn't the way I practice.
Well, that's it. They're all... Practitioners may not practice that way, but the literature is all about the child archetype.
Yeah.
And... Certainly, I've heard enough discussions of therapists where they take the question back to childhood. And what about all the groups that meet on Tuesday evening and talk about their mothers and their fathers and so on? It's a big theme is the child, childhood and the child.
But if it empowers them, then they can be political actors for them. Empowerment is certainly one of the goals.
That's the goal. And that's an old Jesuit argument. The end justifies the means. I'll keep you out of politics for the next 7 years because in the end you're going to be better. You'll be better in the world. That's Jesuit thinking. The end justifies the means. If the end doesn't show in the means, it's not moral. If those persons are not engaged at this moment in some way or another politically, and I don't know exactly what I mean by engaged, then the end is not showing in the means. Then the empowerment that you're giving them is not occurring. It's a postponement. How about that?
The original politics is the family, and therapy is to empower them within even the remembrance.
That's a theory that the original politics is the family. That already removes you from the polis. What culture would say that? Only our culture, only our psychotherapeutic culture says that. If you lived in 50 other cultures and something went wrong with you, you began to go zzz, right? And you had symptoms and you had this and you had that, you got diseases and you fell out and you were crazy, you'd either look for witches or demons or poisons or broken taboos or food mistakes or evil spirits or something or other, but you would never imagine that it was your mother and father. Or that it was something that happened to you 28 years ago. But that's our myth, and I'm questioning that myth.
But by contrast, many other cultures have considered kings and still tribal leaders as the father of the tribe. So I think it is projected out into the larger world. They might not look for the solution to the person's problem within
their personal family. Or their personal childhood.
But
that's politics. That's not personal family. Just because they call the king the father doesn't mean, you don't have to understand that in our way, that that's a projection of the personal father.
But that's how I see you still, not you, just
me. Oh, you can say me.
Still locked in. Well, when you were addressing suffering and beauty coming out of that, I'm sure there's all these other cultures, subcultures, they don't feel that. And to me, that was very Jesuit and Christian still yet, our society, our culture, that Christ suffered, and you have to suffer, and then the beauty will come out of it.
Mm.
I just think that's passé long. I don't have to suffer. Then the psychoanalysts come along, I'll help you through it. It gives you value. Nobody should have to suffer. You just live in this state, you don't have to work through anything. And I never think about alchemists, that's where understanding comes from. You stood under the experience, you worked through it, and then you were whole.
There's a little irony there. A little irony, an edge of irony in that.
So, well, I was still fighting the idea of empowerment. That you're empowering the patient by working through the childhood, and then they will be able to be politically active. See, I think we live very luxuriously. We were talking there in the break, right there, about we can live in our society. The Greeks couldn't, or the Renaissance people couldn't really live in their society and not be engaged politically. We can. You can live your whole life and never write a letter to the newspaper, never go to any kind of town meeting, never vote. You can parasitically live off the polis in our culture. But many people do. Now, that wasn't the case in the original ideas of democracy or in the Greek or the Italian city-states. It was life and death. You had to be involved. You'd get killed. You've got to join with somebody for protection and so on.
Might get killed anyway.
Yes, might get killed anyway. But we don't realize what a strange kind of dissociation we live in that sense. And I still want to say that I think therapy doesn't help us get involved. So that's part of the answer. Now, I mean, part of trying to respond to what you said. What did I mean? And now, what's that to do with archetypal psychology? It has to do with that the archetype of the child, if it dominates therapy, continues to promote our non-participation.
In adult things like that.
Yeah, in adult things like that. Yeah. Right. So there's a danger of the child archetype in projecting future, following Jung's ideas, futurity, growth, and origins, but not communal engagement.
You're not saying don't look at it. You're saying don't get stuck in it, right?
Well, I think it's so automatic that we look at it that I'm even saying don't look too much at it. It's such an automatic habit of mind to look backward and to think of yourself in terms of childhood and parents and so on, that what would happen if you dropped that way of thinking? What would happen if you dropped the origins fantasy? You know, how did it begin? Where did it come from? And just dropped that. Became a mystic and said, all origins are veiled. So I have no idea how anything began. Well, this is a setup, isn't it?
I was once explaining to my Jungian analyst years ago how I was what a particular dream was regarding a childhood experience of mine when I was five, and how that had me all screwed up for the rest of my life and all that. Mm-hmm. And she commented to me something the effect of, well, okay, but that was when you were five. What are you doing now? Mm-hmm. You know? And it was like, it really hit me. Yeah, I'm no longer five. Mm-hmm. Life is going on.
Right. Yeah. That's very Jung, because Jung was not concerned with that. But I don't know, maybe it's different in Seattle, but most of the places I go that have Jungian analysts, they are very concerned now with this whole question of developmental psychology.
We don't have very many Jungian analysts.
Maybe that's why you're saying that. <one. laughs> Okay, now we're winding down. Does anybody want to bring up something or that hasn't? Yeah, please.
Yes, I'd like you to talk a bit about the distinction between anima and soul.
I don't think I can do that.
We spoke quite a bit earlier, going round and round about putting soul into the world. Really, you know, what happens in this interaction with the world and soul? And we spoke of things animate, and this keeps coming back to me, the animalness which you are so fond of. I don't think that there's so much distance between them.
Between animal or anima?
Well, they come from the same root.
Mm-hmm.
And animal basically means life in its most elemental
mm-hmm.
meaning.
And so, go on, just make it a little clearer what I should be doing.
You talk a lot about soul, or you write a lot about
mm-hmm.
it. And it's really not a very clear concept.
No, it isn't. No, but I did in both in revisioning psychology and in archetypal psychology and suicide and the soul and so on, try to give some fundamental things about it. But I think you asked to connect it with anima.
I'm asking you to distinguish the virtue because I find them very close.
Yeah. They are. And I think that when one is soul intoxicated or soul identified, as I tend to be, of all the different archetypes, the one that grabs me is either Puer or Anima or Hermes or Mar. But anyway, but mostly then the whole the way towards soul is romantic. So some of what I am saying is a repetition of what people said in the early 1800s, the Romantics. They were concerned with the animation of the world. They called it pantheism then. They were concerned with revolution, democracy. They were concerned with desire that went beyond the immediate. They were concerned with elaborate language, poetic language. Wordsworth, and so on. They were concerned with many of the Plato and Neoplatonism. They were concerned with the sensate world. Keats's poetry, for example, very sensate. Now, all of those are in a sense anima aspects, and they are also love, basic all the way through. The Romantics is the love of love, which is not important in classic, the generations before them. So those concerns, those interests, those qualities, whatever you want to call it, is part of the way I've been talking about soul.
What is it that is in anima, in the concept anima, that you would exclude from the concept soul?
Oh boy.
Just a couple.
Yeah, I know what you mean. What I have trouble with is imagining them mainly as concepts. I think what I would exclude is that soul is dealt with much more, can be dealt with more conceptually as psyche. And anima is not. It has to be imagined in terms of figures and moods and images and emotions rather than as definitions.
Okay.
Yeah. It's not a concept.
Do you consider soul an archetype? Is it your animal?
No, I'm not going to do this. I don't do that. Because I don't want to talk about an archetype either. I use the word archetypal as an adjective, and it's a valuation. It's a valuative word.
You said that when an archetype.
Because I was answering your question. I don't want to do it. I don't want to do that. I'm going to take the balls that I want to hit.
I'm wondering how come I just started reading the book. How come you? Tend to term anima as feminine, spirit as masculine.
Only because I was following a tradition that both Greek and Latin, that anima is the Latin word for soul and it's a feminine ending.
I understand that.
Yeah. And psyche was a feminine ending too, or feminine word. And animus was a masculine one, and spiritus, and...
So that's not to be... I'm not to confuse that, or I can if I want to, but... with any statement having to do with gender.
Well, that's another area I try to avoid as much as possible, is the one about gender. Yeah.
I have difficulty when I, in your work, like visiting psychology, which I recently read, when I see that, and I see that there's a gender difference.
Well, I've written a lot about anima as being, I mean, chapters, and deliberately trying to say that anima is as relevant for women as for men, and the experience of soul is as relevant for women as for men. And that a feminine phenomenon, a phenomenon that has a feminine end, is just as relevant for men as for women. The goddess Venus is as relevant for women as for men. So it's not only relevant for men, or Hera, or Gaia, or whatever. Just because it's a goddess doesn't make it only for women, or just because it's a god doesn't make it only for men. But these affect all of everyone's lives. So anima would affect men and women equally, with the desire for beauty, the feelings of enchantment, the longings for something beyond, the pull into the deeps. Those are things that men feel and women feel. Even children feel.
What of the notion of anima as soul bearer?
Mm-hmm. That's okay. No trouble with that. And that the engagement with anima, I think, makes one more psychological. I think I wrote about that. By that I mean more complicated, more concerned with brooding and stewing and also more interested in intricacies and subtleties. Well, are we pretty near there?
Would you say the name again of your biologist friend?
Adolf Portmann, P-O-R-T-M-A-N-N. And there are some things of his in English, but not much. Adolf Portmann. Yes.
When you talked about Aphrodite, who were you drawing from? You said the Neoplatonists.
It's in Plotinus, and it's in, I think in the Renaissance Neoplatonists, probably in Ficino. But I'm not certain. I'd have to look, but I think so. Yeah.
While we're getting references, is there a good book on Neoplatonism?
There are a lot of them. Introductions to it, so on. The best man is a man named Armstrong, A.H. Armstrong. But there are a lot of them. Dillon, D-I-L-L-O-N. I'm sure the Elliott Bay, he would have some ideas where you could...
Are you saying that the way to... The way to get away from the child archetype as the archetype that describes contemporary psychotherapy is to ensoul the world.
Did you repeat the question?
Yeah, the question was, am I saying that the way to get away from the child archetype that tends to dominate therapy is to ensoul the world? It's a funny thing, that, because the child also lives in an ensouled world. So it isn't really to get away from the child archetype only. It is to restore an aspect of the child archetype that the personalization of it and the historization of it into my personal history with my parents in my childhood home, in my house, and all the things that happened to me has turned that child into an unhappy child and made us lose the romantic child, Wordsworth's child, who enters the world in love with it and connected with it. So psychotherapy's concentration on the victimization and molestation and ruination of the child has, I think, hurts our relation to the world as an animated place. Because that child's also the source of a great deal of beauty and wonder. All right? I think it's a good time to end. You must be zapped, everybody.